you for joining us for live paranormal radio. From the paranormal to the unexplained, it all happens here.
It all happens here.
Looking to enhance your radio experience? Participate in our live video chat 24/7 with our live paranormal radio show hosts and other like-minded people. Live. Paranormal.com, the only interactive social chat room supported by Full Interaction Media. Stop by now and join the fun.
Stop by now and join the fun.
It's raising the vibration right here on the Live Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, Sheena Metal. I'm a psychic medium. I'm an interfaith minister. I'm a 27-year talk radio host. And Raising the Vibration was the first outreach of a movement of peace and love and kindness and unity that I founded to carry on my mom's teachings, both spiritual and humane, in 2016. RaisingTheVibration.org is the movement. RaisingTheVibrationRadio.com is the show. And for about a year and some now, we've been at the Live Paranormal Radio Network and all of its syndicates, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Podomatic, Podbean, Blog Talk Radio, Player FM. The list goes on and on and on and on and on. Wonderful to be here with you all. Every week on the show, we talk about what are you doing to make the world a better place? What is your passion? What's your mission? What is your service? And how are you using that to ascend, evolve, inspire others, and put more love into the world? And my guest today is a wonderfully creative entity, producer, writer, actress, now doing her own solo performance, and just a great person all around. I think you're going to love getting to meet her. She's been on my shows before, but this is her first time on this show, and I'm so glad to have her. So please welcome to the show, if you would. The most fantastic Dee Freeman is here. How are you, my friend? It's wonderful to hear your voice, and I hope to see your face soon when we all can see faces again.
You are too kind, Sheena, my darling. How are you?
I am wonderful. It's fantastic to hear from you, and I'm glad that you are out and about and doing things in the midst of all we have going on right now in the world, because artists need to keep making art, right?
You know, I felt like 2019 and 2020 was just like an ugly blur, so I am grateful for any little piece of entertainment I can get today, because it has been a dry few years and I am tired of it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's been a strange time. I mean, people talk now about, oh, can't we go back to 2019? But I tell you, for me, 2019 was a strange year. So yes, when 2020 yes. started, I was like, thank God it's over. This is going to be the best year of my life. And then March came and I got COVID. Yes. So, 2019 was really much a year of shedding off, right? And I think that of letting a lot of things go and dealing with who I wanted in my life, who I didn't want in my life, what I wanted from my career, what I wanted from my body. It was a strange year. So it's kind of been a strange year followed by two more strange years of hibernation. So I'm ready for 2022, and I guess you are too.
I couldn't agree with you more. What COVID did was force me to address issues that I have perhaps spent my entire adult life running away from it. I mean, you're in isolation, you're not around your family, you're not around your friends, and I had to look inside of that closet. So I can honestly say that it was the best of times, but it was also the worst of times. In the long run, I came out ahead because all of this stuff that, you know, your closet is so full. I mean, that door was bulging. I opened it up, girl, and said, come on out. It's time for me to air some of this stuff. So in a lot of respects, I am grateful for that, because that's exactly what it made me do, and that's the reason why I am now doing my solo show, for that reason, dragging it out of the closet.
Taking all the stuff, right? I mean, it's an important thing to do, and I think globally, and I talked during my interfaith services about how I believe the spiritual lesson in the pandemic was everybody in the world was dealing with the same thing, so it could no longer be an us and them thing, right? And it forced us all globally, through having so much time to do nothing else, clean out our closets, right, both literally and figuratively. And we did. So it's been different for all of us, right? We've all done different things because of it. And I can't wait to hear about what it was like for you. So let me ask you, before you tell me,
mm-hmm.
all these things you had dealt with your adult life until now,
mm-hmm.
why do you think that was? And what was your coping method to not deal with them?
I think I just left it in the closet and ignored it for years. My friend made a comment to me. I've known her now for well over 30 years, and she said something that I had to laugh. She said, you know, we called you the big liar. There are some things in your past that, for me, they were so atrocious that I lied about it. But I couldn't remember what lie I had told what friend. And trying to keep up with the lies at some point just became, I mean, I couldn't keep up with them. And it was me one day remembering that conversation we had where I asked myself, but why have I told these lies? It wasn't like what happened. I caused it. I was a victim like everybody else, but I felt like I became a part of the big lie by, you know, making it even bigger than it perhaps. And when I was sitting here in COVID and all this time on my hands and the minutes are slowly dragging by, I started slowly pulling stuff out of the closet and saying, why have you left it in there so long, and when were you ever going to take it out? And I think, you know, I don't know how spiritual I am, Sheena, to be honest, but I know that I look and I think COVID happened for a reason. I said there's got to be a reason. For me, it was, girl, you better look in your damn closet and address some of the stuff that you have pushed to the back.
Yeah.
And that is something I will forever be grateful for, because that's exactly what I did, Sheena.
But isn't it silly how we hide things from ourselves?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
from others.
We do.
And that others don't care. They're not going to judge.
But you know what? I think we judge ourselves. That's the problem. And we are worse
yeah.
on ourselves than perhaps. And that was, I have put this show up before. And, you know, in the back of my mind, I was thinking, you know, they're going to call you on the carpet for it. Now, all this happened when I was 7 years old, but I felt in the back of my head, but there's going to be one person who's going to say, you know, you kind of did contribute to that. You know, we, the things that we do to ourselves, I envisioned, you know, people being more judgmental of me than I was of myself. So
yeah.
at
right.
some point I just decided, bring the judgment on, because I'm just not going to keep it hidden anymore. I felt like for my spiritual growth, I had to release it, Sheena.
And you're going to become more spiritual because of it. I'll tell you a little secret. So my mom and I were about as close as two people could be. And she told me my whole life, there's a thing I haven't told you. Someday I will. So I'm imagining, like, you know, she killed somebody. So one day I'm 25 years old. I'm in my own house, and we're sitting on the couch. And she says,
right.
I think it's time for me to tell you the thing. And I understand if you're upset and you don't want to talk to me for a while, I just hope you'll come back to me. So I'm thinking, like, what did she do?
Murder.
What she did was she was dating a guy who raped her, and she got pregnant, and my grandparents made her give the baby up for adoption. That was the thing that she had been carrying around as this great sin the entire time.
She thought you would judge her for
really
that?
She thought I was going to be angry at her because of
wow.
that. But
yeah.
isn't that how
mm-hmm.
we as victims, right? We
yeah.
decide
mm-hmm.
we did something to cause it.
Right.
And everyone's going to be angry at us.
That is amazing that she would think that. But, you know, if I were in her shoes, I could perhaps see myself thinking the same thoughts.
Right? 33 years she carried that around.
Wow.
And didn't tell a soul.
Not...
And thought that I, of all people, would judge her like she had done something. And I don't know which part of that horror story she thought I would judge her for, but
right.
none of it
right.
was her fault. And as soon as she told me and I was like, well, you didn't do anything, then instantly she became okay with telling people. And she became
yeah.
very open about it when I got involved in the Vagina Monologues, which you've done for me, when I got involved in producing and directing that, she
mm-hmm.
She became very much like, tell people. Please tell people
wow.
a part of the story. If it helps at a fundraiser or something, tell people my story. So just getting it out there. And I hope for you it's been that same kind of catharsis of there is nothing – well, there are some things too awful to share, but usually the people who are holding things in are the good people that have been victimized by somebody else.
I felt – I can't even tell you, Sheena, it was – the very first time I told it, I swear to God, I had to have lost 100 pounds. It was so – freeing just to utter those words, because for so many years I had this natural block where I would say something and then I wouldn't go any further. And to actually be able to just put it all out there at once was one of the most freeing experiences of my life and the best thing I could have ever done. And then it made me wonder, why did it take me so long to get to this point? But I accept that I had to go through this process. So, yeah, putting it out there has just made me. And now I can't – there are still things about it now. And I'm pretty sure that your mother, maybe there were some things that – there are still some things about it, Sheena. I look and I go, okay, maybe you'll tell all this stuff over here. Not quite this piece right here. You know, there are still parts of me that kind of go, not yet.
Yeah, for her, they were parts she had blocked out. Like, she had always suspected. I mean, short story, dating a guy – she wanted to break up with him. He wanted to get more serious. So I think he got her pregnant to keep her around because he was all about dragging her to her parents and trying to marry her. But she was like, I don't want to marry this guy. I don't even like this guy. I was trying to get out of this relationship. So years later, we were watching TV. My mom loved crime shows, ironically. And there was some law order special victims unit. And they were talking about, she had always suspected that somebody had roofied her, which in her day was called getting a Mickey, right? And we were watching the show, and she looked at me, and she said, oh, my God, I remember before that date, we going by this house, and I'm pretty sure that's where he picked up the drug. But she had just, that was gone, and then it came back. Because once you open that channel, right, then all the memories start to come back that you've been suppressing. And but all those memories are so not healthy for you, right?
Right. Yeah. That's what we do to ourselves, Sheena. I don't know what that is about us as humans, but, and in particular, I think women more so than men, that we will make it 100,000 times worse than it needs to be.
Right.
And yeah, I've had friends who've told me stories, and you know, and I look at their eyes, and you can see the pain, but I can also see. A lot of times those same friends are looking at you and they're wondering if you're going to judge them for it, you know, and I don't know. I think that's why maybe we got times like, you know, COVID that came around and said, I think there needs to be some house cleaning. So
It's time for everyone to clean out their closets. Absolutely.
Everybody.
So how much
that's
is this?
Right.
How much of this will you talk about? I mean, I don't want to make you talk about anything you're not comfortable with, sweetie.
Oh, no. I can, I'm going to talk up to the point where the perpetrator is arrested. And I don't mind talking about that at all. I really don't, you know. It's like the more I talk about it, Sheena, the more freeing it is for me, I'm finding. So, yeah, have at it. Anything that you want to ask me about it. I'll be happy to.
Why don't you start at the beginning and tell us what the basis of your solo performance is about?
Okay, all right. I prepared a 5-minute piece that might explain a 5-minute blurb from it. If you want to hear that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, please. It's all yours. The microphone is yours, darling.
Okay. Thank you, baby. It's called Poison Gun. I am the fifth child born to Leona and Earl Smith in Tallulah, Louisiana. My parents were farmers, mostly cotton crops, and we lived on about 100 acres. Now, about a mile and a half down the dirt road from us lived my mama's parents, my granddaddy Archie and my grandmama Elvi. My granddaddy was my best friend, and the element that bonded us was math. We were both born good at it. We could add, multiply, and divide really fast in our heads. In fact, some people called us human calculators. Now, there were two things about my granddaddy everybody knew. One, he was legally blind. And the second thing that a lot of people laughed about, he hated banks with a passion. A bank had swindled him once, and he never forgot it or forgave it. So instead of putting his hard-earned money in a bank, he buried his money in these huge, ugly, rusty Folgers coffee cans all over his property. And if I remember right, he had more than 17 of these cans scattered all over his 100 acres. And because his eyesight was so bad, he chose me to help him manage and bury his money. I was only 4 years old when I became my granddaddy's banker. And I promised granddaddy I would never, ever tell anyone where these banks were buried. It was our secret. And granddaddy had quite a bit of money to bury. He made moonshine, and he was very successful at it. Then one cold night in December, my dad rushed into my bedroom and said, "Your grandparents' house on fire." I jumped out my window and ran down to my grandparents' house in a panic. It looked like a scene from Dante's Inferno. I looked everywhere, but I couldn't find them. Exhausted, I fell asleep under a tree, and I woke up the next morning in my bed. I jumped up and ran into the kitchen, and my mama said, "Your grandparents are dead." Dead. Now, dead is a word that is universally understood by everybody except for me at the age of 7. I didn't know what dead was because I had never been around anybody who had died before. But I watched a lot of television, and I had seen actors who died on one TV show come back on another TV show. So at age 7, dead wasn't permanent. It was a place you went to and then came back from. So I'm sitting there at the funeral, and I'm looking, you know, I'm looking at these two caskets, and I'm thinking about that word dead again. Something wasn't right. Something wasn't resonating with me about it. So I decided to go ask someone. I went to somebody who was a lot older than me and much more sophisticated. My good friend Katie Booker, who was 8 years old. Oh, she had been to California 2 times. Katie knew stuff. When I asked Katie what dead was, she thought about it for a minute, and then she said, "I heard my mama tell my auntie that my daddy was dead to her, but he came back in a month. So your grandparents will be back in a month." So the day after the funeral, my mama said the cops wanted to talk to me because they were out investigating the cause of the fire. And she said, "Make sure you say yes, sir, and no, sir, and you answer all their questions." And I did. The lead cop was Officer Duke, and I spoke with him for over an hour, and he didn't ask me any questions about my grandparents. And after that day, I didn't think I'd ever see them cops again. But then somebody, while they were investigating the fire, told them about my granddaddy's money, and they came back. Except this time, they didn't ask my parents' permission. They waited until my parents went into the fields to farm. Then they pulled into our yard. I immediately shot outside like a rocket, but I noticed they weren't smiling. They wanted to know where that money was buried. I was shocked that they knew about my granddaddy's money. And I said, "Uh-uh. No, granddaddy didn't bury no money. No, sir, he didn't have a nickel, not even a penny. Granddaddy didn't even know what money was." I was a terrible liar, and they knew it. That's why they kept coming back for weeks. Officer Dukes wasn't as nice as the first time. He yelled at me, and he told me I was going to burn in hell. And I remember thinking, "Granddaddy, please hurry up and get back before this cop find your money." That winter and into the spring, these cops interrogated me somewhere between 30 or 40 times. And just when I thought my little head would explode from all the lies I was telling, he asked me something else. On this day, the last day these cops would interrogate me, he wanted to know about people's whereabouts the day of the fire and what they had been doing. He asked about my parents, my neighbors, even the mailman. And I was so relieved he wasn't asking about my granddaddy's money, I readily answered all their questions. I even filled in details they weren't aware of. And I felt important because Officer Duke was writing down everything I said. He had never taken notes before. So the next morning I came running into the kitchen, and my mother was sitting at the kitchen table staring into space. And she said, "They arrested your daddy, and you got to testify. You don't know what these words mean, do you? Arrested is when they take you to jail because you've done something bad. They say your daddy killed your grandmama and granddaddy." And I said, "No, he ain't killed them. They are dead. They are dead, and they're coming back in 30 days. And my mama said, what? Child, what nonsense is you talking? Listen to me closely. Your grandparents is dead, and they never coming back. Not ever. Dead and killed, same thing. And that's when I finally realized in horror, my grandparents would never be back.
I lost the line, but I had it muted because I didn't want to interrupt your flow.
So that's,
Wow. Wow. So where was the shame wrapped around in that? Was it that you didn't want people to know that your father had been accused of that?
Well, when all of this happened, the neighborhood as a whole turned against us. A lot of the shame is in remembering, as a child at the age of 7, that kind of hatred coming towards you for something that you don't even understand. Part of the shame was I had to testify against my father based on stuff that I told them, stuff that they weren't aware of. So for years, Sheena, I honestly thought I single-handedly was the cause that my father went through what he did. When Officer Duke asked me questions, I rattled off, just told them everything. I remember feeling jubilant because they weren't asking about my granddaddy's money, not realizing the danger was in the questions that he was asking, because what I said was the opposite of what my father had said. So it was, that was a lot. Remembering the way our childhood friends were no longer allowed to play with us anymore. I mean, we went down to a friend's house, and I think it was 2 days after my father got arrested, and these were people we had sleepovers with. And I remember the mother came out and she said, get the fuck off my porch and don't never come back here again. And me and my brother and sister, we were so concentrated on the fact that, see, adults didn't cuss around us. And we were like, oh, my God, she said the F word. But the longer we stood there, the longer we realized, did she really mean for us to get off the porch? We concentrating on the F word, not on the fact that she told us to get away. It was remembering.
Right.
It's kind of the stuff that happened to you when you're a child. Man, it's kind of hard a lot of times to shake as an adult. I carried that into adulthood. So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, it's hard. Now, this is just my suspicion, but do you think when they kept coming around the police and asking about your grandfather's money, I mean, were they looking for a motive or were they looking for that money?
They were looking for the money. Are you kidding?
It was
very clear. Absolutely.
They thought there was free cash buried in the yard and they were going to help themselves to some.
Right. And I explained to people, because I told my story to a friend years ago, and, she thought I was so brave for not telling the cops how my granddaddy's money was. And I explained in the show the reason why I didn't tell. But, yeah, those cops wanted the money. Two or three people told them to talk to me because there were only two people who knew where my granddaddy's money was buried, and that was me and my granddaddy. So a lot of people kind of bashed my mother and father for that, said, well, where were your parents? Why were they allowing this to happen? I'm like, you guys, this was a different era and a different place. Back then, when we ran out of our house at 7 o'clock in the morning, in the South, in the country, our parents did not see us until 5 o'clock that evening when they called us in for dinner. Like, my parents had 100 acres, grandparents had 100 acres, the neighbors on either side of them had 100 acres, and I could be at any of those spots. Those cops waited until my parents went way out in the field to farm, because they were cotton farmers, before they pulled into our yard. So my mother didn't know for decades. She had no idea. She told me, I told her like 15 or 20 years later, And she became very upset. She said, I did not give those cops permission to talk to you a second time. And that's when we started kind of putting two and two together, that the cops were interrogating me behind my parents' back. Now, they said, did other people see it? Yeah, there were neighbors who saw me talking to them. But I was granddaddy's best friend. They were talking to everybody, so they figured it was normal for the cops to be talking to me also. So
isn't that an interesting thing? I mean, I think it still happens. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. And a lot of my family are police officers, so I don't say that with any hate for the police. But I mean, I think there's dirty people and good people in every profession. But I think back then, before there was DNA and computers to log evidence and ways to check records, it was very easy to just go and take something and nobody would know, you know, go out there by yourself, nobody follows up on it, or take a little something out of the evidence locker, who's going to know, you know what I mean?
Nobody would have. And the big difference also was the two cops, one was black and one was white. The one who did all of the interrogation was the white cop. The black cop, I asked my mother about that, she said, I did. He was just a cop name only. The white cop had all the power, and there were a couple of times when dude put Officer Harvey back in his place. It's like, you will stand your ass there and listen to what I'm doing, but you have nothing to say about the interrogation. I mean, the black cop never said anything, because when he did, Officer Duke would look at him like he was an idiot.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there was a lot that happened back then, a lot that was covered up. The cops got away with the lock. Like you said, there was no DNA for them to check, or, you know, they didn't have the records like they do today. I mean, the FBI with their files and all that, they didn't have that. So, yeah, there was a lot of that happened back then. So thank God for technology being where it is today, because I think we have a lot more people in prison that shouldn't be. But, back then, it's pretty much.
Yes, and a lot of people – a lot of people are in prison that wouldn't have been if DNA hadn't gotten great. Because
a lot of people were done like 30 or 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm one of those who believe that if we find out you've given somebody 30 or 40 years in prison, I'm like, now this is the person who should get $5 or $10 million. When you didn't took that much time for somebody's life and afterwards just said, sorry, I just don't think that's good enough, Sheena. I think they need, I mean some serious restitution, because we have a lot of people today.
I agree. Well, don't you think nowadays if that happens, somebody will usually sue the police department, sue the prosecutor's office. I mean, there's a lot of lawsuits. But back then, you were just so thankful to be out of jail, out of prison.
And it destroys your life. I mean, it truly does. Unfortunately, in a lot of cases, some of the people who have been exonerated, there's still those who think, well, you just got lucky, or you just got a great lawyer who got you off. There's some people who still believe you committed a crime and you're just getting lucky.
Yeah.
So, I look at this and I think what this did for me, I think what really started for me, there's something called the interrogation. I think it's called the interrogation of Michael Crow. There and watch that documentary in that field. I just felt like my head was going to explode, because it was this kid who was interrogated behind his parents' back, and they told him, said, you know what, if you admit to doing this, we'll let you go home. He admitted it. And they only said that so they could put him in prison. It has made me more of an advocate of when I see, like, those cops should never have been allowed to interrogate me. And the fact that they did this behind my parents' back, just, you got so many other kids who have been in the same boat.
Yeah. Yeah, it's totally true. And it's nice that you're telling the story, and not just for now. I mean, it's still happening now.
Right.
But especially for people who are your age or older, when people didn't have any rights. Like, people in general didn't have rights, right?
Right.
Women had no rights. People of color had no rights. And the saddest thing of all, children had no rights. No one cared how children became pawns in things or how children were used. Put a child on the stand, use them for anything. Like, children had no rights, and that's still an ongoing struggle. All of those areas are still ongoing struggles.
Right.
But
they're not thinking about that child's future at all. Really not, you know. You know, how it's going to impact them. I didn't even understand what my mother said I had to testify. I didn't know what testify meant. I didn't understand what it meant or what ramifications it would have for me in the future. And I think that perhaps is kind of like what they do today, where maybe they'll talk to a child in a room, you know, away from, you know, being on the stand. I think that's perhaps one of the best ways to do it, but I was taken down to the courthouse, me and my brother, you know. So I object that, because that can be so traumatic on a child. And it's not like you can just shake that, you know, as soon as you walk out of that courthouse. That lives with you forever. It never leaves you.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. No, I agree. And it's so did you have to testify? Did you testify?
Well, I explain in the story, I was slated to testify on the third day, and I won't say anything further than that. I'll be performing this show on February 9th at the White Fire Theater in Sherman Oaks. And first,
a great theater.
I think, yeah, people are afraid of, you know, I understand that with there being a virus out there that's, Brian Rasmussen, who's the owner of the White Fire Theater, I mean, he's taken, like a lot of other theaters, a lot of precautions. They've got filters in the theater now. They sanitize before every show. They check everyone's vaccination. If you're not vaccinated, you got to have a negative test. Everybody has to wear a mask. So I want to say that about the theater before. And I've also decided the theater holds 90 people. I'm going to cut off the amount of tickets that I sell because I would just feel better having an audience of maybe half that. That way, that's my bit of saying, acknowledging that a lot of people are afraid, but I would still like the audience, nevertheless, I'll put that out there. But, yeah, I'm not going to try to get a sold-out house for this because we don't really have to. We're also doing it online with the same link that they get for the live theater. There's a link for a video on demand, a streaming. So,
oh, that's wonderful.
You know, yeah, absolutely. So that theater has, because, yeah, I mean, I'm thinking if we don't get back to live theater, I mean, Sheena, I feel like I am going through a drought that is just never ending.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's scary. And people don't understand. You know, I have a friend who lives in Arizona, and she was like, are you going to do the vagina monologues this year? And I'm like, what? No, nobody would come. Nobody would come, I mean, to perform in it because people are so scared of their health, right? You have to find a theater, and we always sell it out, and you don't want to do that. And, I mean, it's just too much.
Right.
And maybe next year, if we're still in this situation, I'll think about doing a Zoom version, but Zoom's not reliable, and it cuts out and it drops out. I don't mean just Zoom. I mean all Zoom-type programs, right? All the software, they all have drops and blips and problems, and it's just something
not
that can wait until we're out of it.
Yeah,
you know
it's not
I mean?
The same. Yeah, it's. I have done Zoom, and it is nowhere near the same, Sheena, not even close. So, you know, it's like, yeah, we'll do it online, but I don't get the same adrenaline rush that I get when I set foot in the theater. It just isn't there.
Sure. Yeah. And I think maybe those things for me, let's see what happens next year, how restless I am. I mean, I didn't do it in 2019 either because I threw out my knees during a musical in 2018. I fell off the stage. That's a whole other story that was not properly
The
glow-in-the-dark tape was not put in the right place, and they switched the lights on opening night, and I couldn't see the cutout of the step and fell off the stage. So I spent all of 2019 walking the canyon. So that was my main priority in 2019, was to get walking again. So I did not do it. But so it's been since 2018 for me, and so I would love to get back to it. But, you know, one thing I learned, I don't know, one of the things, we'll talk a little bit maybe about things we learned from the pandemic. I learned during the pandemic a couple things, Dee. One was I never put myself or my health first. I always put the project first. And I understand you have to do that, but at some point you have to stop and say, wait, what about me? The other thing is, like, when I fell off the stage that night, I took a couple ibuprofen and got right back up, and the next night came back and did it again. So the other thing I learned was that everything in its right time, right? Everything doesn't have to happen right now. And and I can wait until it's what I really want it to be before I do it. I think when we grow up as actors, right, we get this sort of ideology, I think, in our first acting class, and I think it's fake, that you have to jump on everything or it might be the last thing you ever get offered.
Right, right.
Maybe for some folks that's true, but certainly you and I, one project is not going to be the last thing we're ever offered.
Right.
So but it's to take a breath and say, I would love to do this, but I'm going to do it when it's right for me.
You know what? But that comes with, maturity, as far as I'm concerned, because it took me a long time to get to that point, to believe that. Now I agree with you 100%. 20 years ago, I wouldn't have agreed with that at all. I certainly got to that point now where there's a right, that's right, there's a right time and place for everything, but it took me decades to get that message. It truly did. I mean, years ago, I wanted it then, I want it right now. That was the way it was, and now I have, I think the older I get, the more I prioritize and understand that, you know what, honey, it might not come today, and that's okay. That's the way I feel, you know, if it doesn't come today, you know, I know that eventually I will get there. And I guess that just comes with, I don't know how long I felt this way. But one day I woke up and felt that. I remember I went out for the Kennedy Center years and years and years ago. And when I was leaving there, I felt, honestly, if I don't get this show, I will die. I swear to God, I said, Jesus, I just won't survive. I will die. And I look back at my young 20-some-year-old self and go, girl, please. I mean, really? Now, I got the show, but I truly felt like I just won't – I can't survive it. And today, I'm kind of philosophical. I'm like, you know what? I will get it or I won't. That's really what it comes down to. I'm going to feel that pain for maybe a minute, and then I'm going to go on about my doggone business. That's the way I am now.
Yeah, I remember reading something once. I think it was Ben Affleck when he wound up having that kind of breakdown and wound up in rehab, and him saying that, you know, all you're doing is trying to get famous. But the more famous you get, the more you're scared you're going to lose what you got, so it gets worse. And I was like that. Like, I would, in my 20s and 30s, I would get something, but then I would be so scared I was going to lose it that I didn't ever enjoy it.
Right, right. I remember
Go ahead. That's something that COVID really was the end of that for me. I still had little lingering bits of that. And during COVID, I thought, you know what? There are worse things. Because I had COVID and then had really bad long haul where I had it. I still have symptoms, but, I mean, it was bad the first year and a half afterwards.
Right.
And so I just thought, you know, I'm so thankful to be alive. I'm not going to sweat the small stuff. And if something happens and I get fired, like if these folks fired me tomorrow, well, somebody else will pick me up, and that's fine. Just, you have to have faith in yourself that there's always another thing coming. Otherwise, you're at the mercy of very toxic people who are almost holding you hostage, right, Dee, by making you think there's nothing beyond that for you.
You know what, girl, that's one of the things that COVID also did for me. There were a lot of, but I think I started doing that years ago, filtering out people who I felt were just not contributing to my, I mean, it's like, I had friends who I felt like, you know, being in the room with them was like they suck all the air out of it. And I finally remember once my mother told me, she said, you collect a lot of what I call the walking wounded. And I didn't understand what she was talking about. I do now. And those people, I have slowly phased them out of my life. And during COVID, I'm looking at that girl, that Rolodex in my head going, okay, wait a minute. who I got here, who I don't, because it's not going to contribute anything to my life. And I'm like, if it's not, yeah, I'm going to have to, you know, sweetheart, I love you, and good luck, my darling. But you and I are just on two different paths. And
I agree.
I always felt like I was letting my friends down if I did that. And now my mother said, but what about letting yourself down? She said, I think you deserve better. And it took me a lot of years to not feel guilt over saying, I perhaps shouldn't have some of these friends in my life that I had who, you know, I'm getting that call at 3 o'clock in the morning because they, you know, they need somebody to, you know, rehash everything that's going wrong in their life, despite the fact that I've got two kids and a husband and a goddamn household to run. I've got to, you know, be a psychiatrist for their problems at 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, I finally had to. I started letting go, Sheena.
I mean, at least those are the ones that are just needy and sad. It's the ones that then help, and then they get angry at you because you help them, and then they become vicious. I mean, it's everything, right? They all have to go.
Yeah. Like, you know what? But I don't feel – I used to feel, guilt over, you know, making that decision.
Too.
And I don't anymore, Sheena. I don't. I'm like, you know what? It's not even about that anymore for me. I'm like, you know what? I got to do what I got to do for me. And, you know, sometimes I feel like telling them, you know, this is going to help the both of us, you know, because some of my friends, I got a friend, and let me say right off the bat, I am all about you going to talk to somebody who's going to make you feel better about yourself. If that's what you need, if that's what gets you up in the morning, that's okay. But this friend has three in her life, that since she was an adult have told her when to eat, when to shit, when to walk, and I'm like thinking, when do you graduate, girl? When do you graduate?
Right.
She never does. And everything that I talk to her about, she's got to go to them and rehash. And I'm like, you know what? This is one of the ones got to go. Got to go, you know.
Well, you know what I realized from that? When I opened my spiritual practice and I started seeing clients, I realized a lot of my friends were actually clients, see, who didn't pay. I was like, wait a minute, these are the same issues that I go over and over and over again with these friends. Nobody sends me a check after the hour's done. I'm in the wrong business. Then I realized I'd always been a spiritual counselor. It's just that it used to be two friends that never got any better or even wanted to get better. I think they were just looking for a place to dump all their stuff.
And they found you.
And they found me, yeah.
Yes.
But that's part of growing, right? We have to grow. And in order to grow, we need to realize the things from our past. You know, I realized that my mom was the same kind of person, right? She was also a gifted spiritual person and a teacher and a therapist. So people would come over and they would just dump all their problems on her. And I saw that and I said, I'm never going to be that person. I'm going to be an actor. So I became an actor who in her spare time, people dumped all their problems on. And, you know, I think we see, right? We see those things. And I think also when you're an actor, you're raised to, I have a friend who was a very brilliant child actor. And he said to me once that when he was little, he got all the jobs because he knew how to do just what he had to do to get them to say yes. And he said, it wasn't until I got the middle of my life that I realized that all those skills that benefited me as a performer damaged me in relationships, because in relationships, you shouldn't be doing everything you have to do to make it work. You shouldn't have to be the one that always compromises and sells yourself and auditions constantly. And that is true, right? And it's funny because our birthdays are 2 days apart. And as he said that, I thought, oh my God, that's me. I do that. I'm a fixer. I make everything work.
Mm-hmm.
And in professional,
mm-hmm.
it's great. You know, the theater set on fire, I'll put the play on outside. The computer goes down, I'll do the radio on my phone. I used to always joke in my Howard Stern radio show days that I could do radio like MacGyver with a piece of dental floss and a – but you know what? In relationships with people, that really sets you up, that people think, well, they can just do anything they want. You're going to make it work.
Right, but what what happened when the fixer needs a little, you know what I'm saying? Who was there
Nothing.
For you?
Yes, nobody, right? That's what you learn, and that's why you have to change your patterning. And I, as I said, that started, you know, around my 40th birthday and had been getting better. But, you know, just, yeah. Sweetie, we are completely out of time. Where can people find you online? And when can they see your show? And let's come back and do this again. I'd love it.
I would love it. Oh, and by the way, before I forget, he'll kill me if I don't tell him. Michael Taylor Gray told me to tell you hello, and he is. He said he's going to talk to you at some point. He has written a musical.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
He said, I'm going to have to talk
to
him about it. Yeah, I told him, I said, I'll pass the word. But anyway, it's called Poison Gun. It's going to be at the Whitefire Theater on February 9th at 8 p.m. Tickets are $25. Online streaming is $19.99. And I would love for people to come out. I am, like I said, this has been I feel jubilant about just performing it. I mean, every time I put it up now, it's a little bit more freeing. And I'm glad coming out of COVID and this spell right now, the time that we're living in now, with the Black Lives Matter movement and everything that's happening, I'm glad to be telling this story now because it has so many, anyone who'll see the show, there's a lot of Black history involved. One of the people who, you know, figure highly in this is my Uncle Willie, who was a civil rights activist. He was friends with Martin Luther King, and there's still people today who think that the people who killed my grandparents were the KKK. So I am at this spot in time right now, I mean, just to be talking to you about this today on Martin Luther King's birthday, I mean, when he was friends with my uncle and aunt who are in the show, I feel honored, you know. I truly do. There are a lot of things in this show, people who are no longer alive, who I want to honor, and that's one of the reasons why I'm putting this show up. Of course, it's cathartic for me, but I think there are people in my past who need to be acknowledged for things they did that were wiped away by one person. Once this evil deed was done, everybody that figured in Louisiana was swept under the rug, and they have stayed there until I started yanking that rug out saying, no, I'm going to bring them out. I think there's some people who should be acknowledged for what they did.
I love that. I love that. Thank you for being here, my friend, and please come and do this with me again. The wonderful Dee Freeman, everybody. She's fantastic. Go out and see her show, and I would love that, or check it out online if you don't feel like being out. I'm Sheena Metal. I'm at SheenaMetalSpiritual.com for all your spiritual needs. This is Raising the Vibration every Friday at 5 o'clock Pacific time. Until I see you next time, seek peace, live in love, lead with kindness, embrace unity. Always raise your vibration, and I'll see you soon. Thanks for being here. Take care.